Okay, we're in the book of Daniel. Can you remember about the time frame that's involved here in this study? Remember when the events recorded in this book, remember when they occurred? In the middle 2000 unit, from we summarized history from in three units of 2,000 years each. From creation down to Abraham is about 2,000 years. And from Abraham down to Messiah or Christ was about 2,000 years. And then from Christ to today is about 2,000 years. So each of those three intervals, we're working in that middle interval. And the time frame we're talking about is roughly about 300 B.C. And I've got a chart somewhere here, and I'll just show you on it about where we're what we're talking about. This is a chart of Old Testament history, and we're working right down here in this time frame here. Nearly all of this chart is in that middle 2,000-year interval. It isn't the scale. Don't try to make it fit the scale. It's not the scale. But we're going to be talking about events that take place right in through here from about 600 B.C. down for the next 70 years or so, roughly in that time frame there. And what's going on in that time frame is that the nation Israel has almost been dissolved. The United Kingdom includes everything you see on this chart in color. Then when it divided, what you see on here is that the northern 10 tribes is what's in orange. And at the time of Daniel, they don't exist anymore. They've already been carried off into Assyrian captivity in 722 B.C. All that is left at the time of Daniel is Judah down here to the south. And I can kind of show you that on this. If you just pay attention to what's in blue, or this darker part here. Now, this was about that all that was left at the time that Nebuchadnezzar came and besieged Jerusalem, and in essence, over a period of about 20 years, he wiped these guys out. So on this other chart, there is no nation Israel left at this time. It's been consumed by other nations. So during this time interval right here that we're talking about, the northern 10 tribes have already been carried off into captivity, and now the southern 2 tribes are carried off into Babylonian captivity during this time frame. And so Daniel is down in Babylon. He's up in Babylon, actually. Let's just look at him here for a second, or look at that geography. The Babylonian Empire was up here in Mesopotamia. See this kind of purple area right here? They're fighting and battling with Egypt down here. And Israel, being right here between the two of them, they picked the wrong side. They picked Egypt, sided with them, and they became then the enemy of Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. And so he then, actually on his way back from fighting the Egyptians to assume the kingship in Babylon, his father just died, he besieges Jerusalem for the first time. He's going to do it 3 times, 10 years apart. Once, 10 years later, 10 years after that. And he takes Daniel captive back here to Babylon and some other people. And we're seeing some of the detail concerning Daniel's stay there in Babylon and that of some of his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego by name. So Daniel and some of his friends have been taken to Babylon, and they've been put in a program that is designed to train them to serve Nebuchadnezzar in the Babylonian government. Sort of like a Rhodes Scholarship type program. All their food's provided for them. They're taught and trained in all the ways of the Babylonians, and they're guaranteed of a nice, fat, cushiony government job when that training is over. And these four guys, Daniel and his three friends, have impressed Nebuchadnezzar more than anybody else, and so they're in very good positions now in the Babylonian government. So God has moved Daniel from Judah to Babylon, put him at arm's length from Nebuchadnezzar, and equipped him to be able to do something in particular. Daniel understood all kinds of visions and dreams, verse 17 of chapter 1. So Daniel is a dream interpreter. So God's got his man in place where he wants him, and he's going to reveal some history, some prophetic history now, through Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar and to readers and everybody else. So He's got his man in place. He's got him trained to do what he wants him to do. And lo and behold, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream. There's actually going to be six visions or dreams in this book. The book revolves around these six visions. Two of them had by Nebuchadnezzar, four of them by Daniel. But the first three, taken collectively, will reveal a period of time known as the latter days or the times of the Gentiles. The term means the same basic thing. It's from the days of Nebuchadnezzar, roughly 600 B.C., down to the second advent. So from Nebuchadnezzar to Christ are the latter days, also called the times of the Gentiles. And we'll see why as we see this vision and explain it. They don't know, the readers of this book don't know how long that is. They don't know anything about the church age, so they don't know about that 2,000 years. So they think, well, we'll talk more about it as we get into the visions and stuff and see what's going to take place here. Okay, so Nebuchadnezzar now has had his first vision. And he's called in all of his wise men and all of these guys that are on the payroll there in Babylon to interpret dreams and tell him everything about it. And he says, okay, guys, now all you have to do is tell me what I dreamed and what it means. Both. Is that too close?
No.
Okay. So he's called in all of his guys, and they said, are you kidding me? I can't tell you what you dreamed. We got a handbook here. We can interpret your dream. We can make something up if you'll tell us what you dream. And he's too smart for that. So he says, well, you bunch of shysters, you don't know what I'm talking about. So he ordered them all to be killed. He's going to chop them up into little pieces. And when that word gets to Daniel, who is part of that subculture in Babylon, he's one of the dream interpreters. He's part of the group that's just been told to be wiped out. He says, wait a minute. I can interpret that dream, or so he thinks. And so he and his buddies get together. They have a little prayer meeting, and God reveals the dream to Daniel. So now Daniel is in a position of telling Nebuchadnezzar not only what he dreamed, but what it means. Okay, so that's where we are. Let's pick the trail up here in Daniel chapter 2, verse 24. So Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows. Don't destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king's presence, and I'll declare the interpretation to the king. So Daniel basically saves the neck of all of this class of guys down there who claim to be interpreters of dreams and that sort of thing. He says, look, I can do it. So Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence, and he spoke to him as follows. He says, I have found a man among the exiles of Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. See anything that's kind of typical of politicians and people like that in that particular deal? Hey, king, I found this guy who came to me and told me, I didn't know nothing about it, but I found this guy. He's trying to pick up points with Nebuchadnezzar, as is typically the case of men, trying to take credit for something they didn't do. And the king answered and said to Daniel, verse 26, whose name is Belteshazzar. Remember, that's his Babylonian name. Daniel, his Jewish name. Belteshazzar, his Babylonian name. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are the Babylonian names of his three buds. He says to him, are you able to make known to me the dream which I dreamed and its interpretation? That is, can you tell me what I dreamed and then what it means? These other guys can't. And Daniel answered and said to the king, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners, nor are able to declare it to the king. These guys can't tell you what you dreamed. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, what will take place in the latter days. What he dreamed has to do with a period of time known as the latter days. That's from his time frame right here at the time of this dream, let's say 600 B.C., down to Messiah. The Jews don't know anything about any age other than the age in which they were living at this time and the next age, which was the millennium. They don't know anything about the church. Remember what Paul called the church? a mystery. All that means is it wasn't revealed before. So these Old Testament guys don't know anything about that. So when they think of the latter days, the days that are toward the end of the era in which they live, which is concluded with the coming of Messiah, they're talking about something that they don't know has got a 2,000-year parenthesis in there called the church age. They just think it's having to do with the latter part of their Jewish history, down to Messiah. So this vision pertains to the time period from Nebuchadnezzar, let's say 600 B.C., down to the second advent. All right, got that in mind? You see the time period that this is going to apply to or explain to us? Okay. The latter days. In other places, it's called the times of the Gentiles. Same thing. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future. The latter days are future for Daniel at this point in time. Most of it's in the past for us. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. Not what might take place, but what will take place. This vision is going to summarize events that absolutely are going to take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. Daniel says, look, I understand this not because I'm anything special, but God is going to reveal this so that you will understand what's going to take place here. And here we go. Here's what you dreamed, Nebuchadnezzar, verse 31. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. And the head of that statue is made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And the reason he couldn't sleep and the reason it scared him so bad is this is what it looked like. Now, if that looks a little goofy, it's because I drew that thing about 40 years ago with a computer mouse. And if you think it's easy to draw curved lines with a computer mouse, you just go try it. And then you tell me how easy it is. It ain't easy. I couldn't even get back to the start point down there on that one arm. At any rate, I just kept this in place because I had it. So it's a goofy-looking statue, but the point of the statue is that it is segmented into four different sections. Each section is a metal. The whole thing is metallic. The head is one metal, the torso is another metal, the middle part is another metal, and the legs and feet are another metal. Four different kinds of metals in this statue that he sees. Head of gold, breast of silver, belly of bronze, and legs of iron and feet mixed with iron and clay. So there's the statue. It was a little more impressive than this one, and that caused him to lose sleep. But we'll talk about what it is here in just a minute and why it was an awesome figure for him to see. So he's looking at this thing. Verse 34 says, you continued looking until a stone was cut without hands. Here comes this stone. It is not a man-made stone. It is cut without hands. And it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. So as he's looking at this awesome statue, a stone comes in and crushes it, hits it right down here on the feet, smashes the feet of this statue into dust. Then the iron and the clay and the bronze and silver and the gold were all crushed at the same time. So when the stone smashes this thing on the feet, the whole statue comes crashing down. And it became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. So the statue gets smashed to dust and blown away. But the stone that struck them became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. That was the dream. All right, got the picture of the dream? The dream is a statue segmented into four different kinds of metals. The bottom quarter of this thing is actually a little more unique than the first three because it is a mixture in the feet of iron and clay. And that is where the stone first crushes this image, is on its feet, that mixture of iron and clay. The whole thing then shatters and dissolves and is blown away by this stone that crushed it. Got the picture? Okay, here's the interpretation of the picture, Daniel 2:36 and following. Here is the interpretation. You, O king, are the king of kings to whom God of heaven has given the kingdom and power, the strength, and the glory. And whatever the sons of men dwell, or wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given him into your hand and caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. What's the gold of this statue represent? The Babylonian Empire and its leader, Nebuchadnezzar. The first segment of that four-segment statue represents the Babylonian Empire. And God has given Nebuchadnezzar and that empire its characteristics and properties, and he is represented by this statue. Verse 39, after you there will be another kingdom inferior to you, then a third kingdom of bronze which will rule over all the earth. So these next two segments are kingdoms also. This one is a kingdom that's inferior to Babylon. Then there's another one that will come that is inferior to it. See the picture here? The succession of world empires are each inferior to the previous one. Then there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron. Inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. So the fourth kingdom down here, the one represented by iron, it's stronger than all of these. It's able to crush and pound every one of those segments into a different shape if it wants to. So even though there is a progression of inferiority as you go down the statue in terms of its government and leadership, the fourth one is stronger than all of the other ones that have preceded it. Kind of getting a picture here so far? Verse 41, and in that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. Will clay stick to iron in any sort of a really tight bond? That's like getting mud on your shoes, about all that is, isn't it? So the last one of these, the toes are represented by clay. How many toes you got? Usually 10. You can have one missing or something, I suppose, but usually 10. So the bottom one down here has some sort of a 10-segment deal to it, made out of something that doesn't stick together very well. It is not a real strong bond. All right? And he says, So as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. So this last kingdom down here at the bottom is a mixture of things that are strong and things that are not. It's not like the others that are solid metals, even though you could take a piece of iron and you could pound that gold head into any shape you want to, couldn't you? Do the same thing with the silver. It's malleable. Same thing with the bronze. That that iron fourth kingdom can pound any of the other kingdoms into a different shape if they want to. Much stronger. But the toes are a mixture of clay and iron, and that is not a strong bond at all. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men. That is a human kingdom of some kind being described there, isn't it? It's the seed of men that is being represented by the iron and clay. But they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. So this last kingdom down here that he's talking about is a kingdom of men, and it does not stick together strongly. It is not a real good bond in that last kingdom. So what we've seen so far is that from Nebuchadnezzar's day down to the time of Messiah, there will be four worldwide kingdoms that will come and go. Babylon is the first one. We'll have to guess at what the second and third one and fourth one are, but we think we can put a good guess on that. We'll do that here in just a minute. But this fourth one down here, this last kingdom, consists not only of a very strong part, but a part that is not very strong, a mixture of iron and clay. Now remember what happened to the feet in this vision. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. There's another kingdom separate and distinct from the four represented in this image. It's created by the God of heaven. It is a divinely originated kingdom. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. For inasmuch as you saw a stone cut out of the mountains without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great kingdom has made known that God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy. So what he has said here now is that God will make a kingdom separate and distinct from these kingdoms that will crush this kingdom at the time this kingdom exists, this fourth one down here at the bottom with the 10 toes of clay and iron mixed. He will crush it at the time that it exists. So God is going to come in and he's going to destroy all of those kingdoms at some point in time. They're all kind of absorbed into each other as they go, and so that's how he can crush it right here and all of them in effect be dissolved and blown away. And God is going to do that. Get the picture of what's been described here now? From Nebuchadnezzar's day down to Messiah will be four worldwide kingdoms. Babylon, and the next one up there we think is Medo-Persian Empire. We'll talk about these as we go along. Followed by the Greek Empire. And the fourth one is the Roman Empire. But that fourth one is unique. It's got some unusual properties. So you got Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. But yet there is a variant of the Roman Empire that consists of 10 different nations combining together, trying to unite together, stick together. They don't stick very well. It's a bad mixture of commitments and joining together there. And during the time that that one exists, God will come in and destroy it. And all of these world empires that have preceded him are destroyed at the same time. Comprende? Questions about what Daniel has said here in this vision so far. Four world empires comprise the times of the Gentiles, the latter days. The Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, and the Roman Empire. And that Roman Empire is kind of odd. It's a little different. We'll see more about it as we go along, because it shows that it's some sort of a mixture of 10 different subsets, toes in the vision, that are made of clay, and they don't stick well to the iron. And during the existence of that 10-nation conglomerate, whatever it might be, God sets up a kingdom and comes in and destroys it all. He smashes it with his kingdom, and they all disappear. Got the picture? Now, this is a vision in chapter 2. In chapter 7 and in chapter 8, we're going to see two more visions that embellish this one. They're no different. They're the same thing. They're just embellished. We get a little more detail, a little more information. So in chapter 2, we see this vision. Come across like this. We've just seen this revealed to us that I tried to summarize for you. We're going to talk more about this as we go along, because this is a very interesting part of all of this. But in chapter 7, we'll see the same basic thing revealed to us. It's just embellished a little differently. And then in chapter 8, we'll see the same thing again, but it's embellished again slightly differently. So those three visions, chapter 2, chapter 7, and chapter 8, are the same basic picture being revealed to us. We're just getting more detail, a little more embellishment as we go along. And this one is the most interesting one of them all. This is the 10 toes right here. The 10 toes that don't stick very well to the iron is the reorganized Roman Empire that will take place during the tribulation period. And it's headed up by a very, very interesting character, the most evil character probably ever been on the planet. We'll talk more about him as we go along. But that's the general picture now of what we're seeing here of these visions. So we got Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. And we'll see some things later that explain to us why this one is so unique and explains this here. So this is, we're going to be back and forth in this chart a number of times, because it captures everything over a few times. Now, let me just mention one thing before we march on here. Can you see the red border there on that map? See this border? Can you see that? That is the border of the old Roman Empire. What this vision has said so far, and is embellished a little bit as we go along, is that from that geography right there will come the 10 toes we just saw in the other vision. The old Roman Empire will come back to life during the tribulation period with some sort of a 10-nation federation from this geography. It won't be exactly the same as what you see here, but it will come from that geography right there. There will be some sort of a uniting together of 10 of those countries, or 10 of those empires, and they're the 10 toes of that vision. Who are they? I don't know. I don't know the exact configuration of them. But somewhere out of these countries will come the 10 toes. Now, right now there's a sort of a loose-knit organization over there now of nations called the European Union. It's a lot more than 10 countries. There's like 27 of them or something like that. It's a whole bunch more than 10. So that ain't it, but it could be something like that. It could be some sort of an economic Union. It could have some sort of a military component to it, a NATO-like component. I don't know. But during the tribulation period, after believers are all raptured off this earth, and remember, the tribulation period doesn't have to start the day after the rapture. The rapture can occur long before the tribulation period starts. We don't know. We usually talk about it like it's the next day, but there's nothing says it is. You could have the rapture and you could have a year go by before the tribulation period starts. What marks the start of the seven-year tribulation period?
Antichrist.
The Antichrist signing a treaty with Israel, that false covenant. Remember, that's what the Lord says. That's how it begins, Matthew 24. And in 3.5 years, he turns on them. And in another 3.5 years, the Lord comes back. So that seven-year interval that marks the tribulation period can begin a year or two or three or ten after the rapture. I don't know. So we don't have to see this 10-nation federation. We don't have to see these 10 toes coming together before the rapture can occur. It can all happen after we're gone. I don't know how long it's going to be. We just kind of think it's going to be fairly quick, but who knows? Maybe the Lord takes us out of here and the world continues to deteriorate for 3 or 4 or 5 more years before that treaty is actually signed. Yes?
Doesn't the Antichrist need time to rise to power? And he confirms a covenant.
Well, he
can sign a treaty.
Well,
he
will have to rise to power at some point in time, and he will have enough positional power at the start of the tribulation period to sign that treaty. So he'll do something to sign a covenant with Israel. There will be something going on that makes these people want to join together in some sort of a 10-nation unit and sign a treaty with Israel. Let me give you a scenario. What happens if Iran closes a Strait of Hormuz, and there's no oil flowing into Europe? Europe gets most of its oil from Iran. What happens if Iran starts throwing missiles at Israel, and Israel starts throwing missiles back at Iran, and you got this big fight going on over there in the Middle East, and there's no oil getting into those countries? What do you think will happen? They can probably form a unit pretty quick, can't they, to try to put an end to that conflict? That may be the driver behind what pulls together some sort of a 10-nation unit of these countries and says, look, we got to get this war stopped because we haven't got any oil and it's cold outside. So let's form some sort of a unit and promise Israel we will protect them if they stop throwing missiles at Iran, and Iran stops throwing missiles at them. Maybe something like that happens. How long would that take to form? 15, 20 minutes maybe? I mean, they could do that in a hurry if things get that bad. If the body bags start piling up in Israel so high they can't even process them, and these people want that oil to flow into Europe, they can probably come to some kind of an agreement. Why are we not in that picture? Why isn't Big Brother in that picture? I don't know why Big Brother isn't in that picture. We have been Israel's protector ever since they've come back as a nation back in the 40s. But clearly we're not in that picture. We may be preoccupied with other things and not able to get in that treaty. I don't know. What other things could preoccupy the United States to where it's not the main policeman on the world stage anymore, I wonder? You know what Yellowstone is, don't you? Yellowstone's just a volcano. What if that thing erupts? What would happen to the United States economy if Yellowstone, which is the core of a volcano, what if that thing rips off? The entire Western United States would be in jeopardy, wouldn't it? What if the San Andreas Fault turns loose at about that same time? Scientists think there's 30 feet of vertical slip stored in the San Andreas Fault. That means it would move 30 feet. One side moves 30 feet relative to the other side. 30 feet. How much infrastructure is left after part of it moves 30 feet vertically from the other part? All of your power lines, all your sewer lines, all your gas lines, all of everything now just got ripped apart from one another for the whole length of the San Andreas Fault.
All wrong.
I don't know. I'm just suggesting that there may be some things that God has up his sleeve that would so preoccupy the United States in terms of just survival that it may not be able to get involved there. That might explain why this is a treaty signed between these people on this map and Israel. Not something you would expect, but if we're no longer a player, if we're preoccupied economically with just surviving as a country, then maybe that makes sense to the Europeans and to Israel to go and sign that treaty. Something will bring them around to relying on these Europeans instead of relying on God, and they'll sign that treaty with the Antichrist. And we're not in it. The United States ain't in that picture. We're out of it for some other reason. I don't know.
There's always a little rocket man.
Beg your pardon?
There's always a little rocket man.
I didn't quite hear you.
There is always little rocket man.
Yeah, yeah. There could be all kinds of... And there will be wars. And by the way, a fourth of the world's population will be killed by wars. 1.8 billion people has to involve weapons of mass destruction. You can't kill that many with rifles. You got to have nuclear wars, and you got to have things like that going on. So there will be some of that. Yes, ma'am.
What is that mid-tribulation point that it changes?
Three and a half years
into it?
He turns on them at the midpoint of the tribulation period. After that treaty is in place for 3.5 of the 7 years for which it was signed, he turns on them himself, on Israel himself.
Israel. Yeah.
Remember, there's a war in heaven, all the angels are thrown out, and they come down here, and all that evil comes down here too. And at that point in time, mm-hmm. he turns on Israel and tries to destroy them, sets himself up in the temple and all that kind of stuff.
The abomination of desolation.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, the Antichrist, another name for the Antichrist. So, this vision now, which is painted with a very broad brush, it doesn't include a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about right now and telling you right now that we think and know from other places. It just says there's 10 toes in the vision, in the statue. And the 10 toes is where God's stone smashes the whole conglomerate. So when he comes back in judgment, all of these world empires represented by successive ones are crushed and destroyed by him. Kind of got the picture in general now. We're going to go over this picture a few more times as we go through these visions. And they will embellish it a little bit as we go. So I just brought this in to kind of give you a little more of a overall feel. You okay with that so far now? The general picture and what's going on here? Who would have thunk it back 600 B.C. that there's going to be these four world empires and the fourth one of them kind of goes dormant for a while and then comes back to life during the tribulation period? They would have no way of knowing that. It's just too bizarre for them to possibly understand. But that's what this vision, I believe, is saying. Now, what happened to Daniel as a result of his telling them all this, verse 46 and following? So King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face after hearing all of this and did homage to Daniel. Well, that's pretty cool. And he gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense. And the king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." Nebuchadnezzar is more than impressed with Daniel and Daniel's God. And he acknowledges God's ability to do these things and to present this kind of information. So he promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Kind of sounds a bit like Joseph, doesn't it? Major promotion day for Daniel as a result of this vision. So Daniel made request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. So Daniel has now been raised to a position of very high authority in the Babylonian Empire, and he's gotten promotions for his friends also to go along with him in running and ruling this place. So my goodness, what a day for Daniel and his friends. All because God put him there and equipped him with the ability to interpret dreams. God had a job for Daniel, so he prepared Daniel for that job and put him in exactly where he wanted him to do that job. I'm falling asleep here. I'm just looking over notes to make sure there's something I wanted to mention to you and have forgotten here. Okay. Now, if you are a Jew reading Daniel's letter here, and you understand it and conclude that, golly gee whiz, from this time going forward, there's going to be these four Gentile world empires that are going to dominate and rule over us Jews, the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans, and in some form of revived Romans, if that's going to take place, what's going to happen to us? Are we going to get completely wiped out? Is the Jewish nation going to get wiped off the face of the earth by these Gentile world powers? You might wonder that, huh? Well, chapter 3, fortunately, answers that question for us. Jeez, you didn't listen fast enough again. We might have to put chapter 3 off until next week. I don't want to get it started and not be able to see it. Let's just pause here and marinate a little bit on what we saw here in the vision in chapter 2. Give you a chance if you have any more questions or comments you want to make about it. We'll save the vision, or the, not the vision, but the experience in chapter 3 for next week. It will come back and answer our question, well, what's going to happen to the Jews if these world Gentile empires are going to dominate them? All right, any questions or comments about chapter 2? Let's stay there and we'll finish up there this morning. Get into 3 next time. Understanding what things, what's happening here? Kind of a lot like Joseph, isn't it? Providential care of God in Daniel's life is very much like the providential care of God in Joseph's life. Daniel had a 3-year training program. Joseph had a 12-year one. Daniel was in a pretty good spot. Joseph was in a prison. He's cleaning out toilets in a prison. Joseph's was. Joseph needed some tweaking in a different way than Daniel did. Daniel's character is phenomenal. We talked about that last week, didn't we? Here's a 17-year-old kid, roughly, who's showing not only just overall judgment and insight, but good, very good spiritual judgment and insight at a very young age. And all God needed to do to get him prepared was to teach him and train him in the ways of the Babylonians. Joseph needed a little, few rough edges knocked off his character. He needed to burn that coat he'd been wearing, and did. And he got rid of that. His brothers got rid of it for him. So he needed a little character adjustment. He needed some preparation, and he got it. Daniel, likewise, needed some preparation, and he got it. So both men were prepared by God for the position that God had brought them to. And providentially, God work through their circumstances to get them where he wanted them to be and prepare them for the job that he had for them. So both lives illustrate that same principle. Just the particulars vary, you know, getting them both ready. But any question about chapter 2? The first of six visions in this book. It is a book of visions, six of them, two by Nebuchadnezzar, four by Daniel. And in those visions, we get this very sweeping panorama of biblical eschatology. These various world empires that are going to run their course and transpire, with the last one of them being a particular interest because it will be taking place right at the end of the present age, just before Messiah comes back, a time period we refer to as the tribulation period, and we won't be here. The 10 toes mixed with iron will take place after we're gone. So we have to kind of think about or guess about that one ahead of time. We're not going to see that one. We've seen the others. But we won't see that last one because it will occur after the rapture.
Don,
yeah, I mean,
is Israel the smallest country in the world today?
I don't know that they're the smallest, but they're pretty small. Mm-hmm. They're only like about 12 million Jews on the planet. And only about half of them, about 7 or 8 million, are in Israel. The rest of them are scattered around the U.S. and other places. There's more Arabs in Israel than there are Jews. So the whole country only has about 16, 17 million population, I think. Seven or eight of them are Jews, and eight or nine of them are Arabs. The rest of the Jews are scattered around the world. And one thing to be aware of and to note, of course, is that Iran has been developing their missile technology. Every time before when Iran messes with Israel, Israel whips up on them. But Iran is getting better with their missile technology than anything Israel's ever combated before. So if they start throwing these missiles at one another over there through their proxies, Hezbollah and those other guys down there in Gaza and whatnot, Israel may take a bigger beating than they've taken in the past. I expect they will. I expect Iran to be more effective at trying to destroy Israel the next time than they have been in the past because of that missile technology, a lot of which comes out of North Korea. Rocket Man in North Korea is helping Iran develop missile technologies that can hurt Israel, reach them further away than they ever have before, than they've had in the past. So Israel will be in a position during the tribulation period where she needs help and she doesn't trust God. She trusts military alliances, just like she did here with Egypt and got in trouble and God judged them and took them off into Babylonian captivity. So when that starts happening and Israel gets in a real bad spot, this European alliance may look pretty good to them. That's why they would side with Europeans instead of us, especially if we're being consumed by other things and really can't get involved too much. Yes?
I'm a little confused on different groups. The 10 alliance, that's one thing in the tribulation. But then there's Russia and Turkey, totally flipped. They used to be an ally, and that was prophesied, and now that's happened. Iran, mm-hmm. Russia, Turkey, and then a couple other little guys. That group is a group that they're supposed to go after Israel. Is that
where, yeah?
Where
the,
is, where
well,
does that fit in everything? It seems like it's kind of hitting there.
There's four military alliances that dominate the tribulation period. One of them consists of Russia and her allies, the ones you just summarized there. Now, this is during the tribulation period now. Another one consists...
Not before?
Well, they could be forming before, but okay. They attack Israel during the tribulation period, Ezekiel 38 and 39. There's a second one that is the Antichrist and his allies.
Okay.
There's a third one that is a North African alliance of some sort. Looks like involves maybe Egypt and Libya and some of those North African countries, and the Antichrist stomps them. And the fourth one is called the Kings of the East, and that would appear to be the Chinese and their allies.
Probably the 200 million.
And that may involve the Koreans. And so during that time frame, those four alliances will battle out. Several of them, the Antichrist, along with some of the others, they'll all try to destroy Israel. None of them will help them. But we'll talk about them later also when we get a little further into this book. We'll look at those too. So Israel will be in a position where this alliance may look quite attractive to them. The Europeans may want to get involved heavily because of an oil problem, which I think is very likely. So there's reasons why that might come together that seem odd to us, maybe because of history. But if we're no longer the police, the world's policemen, Israel will have to sign a treaty with whoever they can get help from. So that's the 10 toes. That's the 10-nation federation that the toes represent in this vision. Who will be in that's hard to say.
So between the end of Rome and the toes, that's we're in that time period.
Yeah, it's in that dormancy or whatever you want to call it, where it kind of looked like it went away, looks like it went to sleep, but comes back alive. It looks like it had died off, but by gosh, here comes the old Roman Empire back during the tribulation period in the form of this 10-nation group, whatever it is. And that's the one we won't see. We might see some foothills of that kind of coming together. We might see enough of it that before we're gone at the rapture, we may think, well, hey, this could be what turns into this 10-nation deal. Maybe it's economic. Maybe it's military. I don't know. But we won't necessarily see, well, we for sure won't see the signing of that treaty because that's after the rapture. But we might see some things that we think this could come to that before we're gone. I don't know. Be okay with me if we got on out of here today and let that stuff happen later on, right? Let them take care of all that. But I don't know how long that interval will be, and we don't know. All right, any other questions or comments? Okay, we'll let you roll. You have a good week, and behave yourselves if you can. And we'll see you next Sunday, Lord willing.